Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Scott Reich of Crime Talk, and there's only one thing on the docket today. First, Lena Dirhali. For those of you who don't recall, she is the author of My Daddy Is My Hero. We had a lot of great response. She is a psychologist. She is very smart. And today we talk about why parents kill their children. Let's talk about it. So today on Crime Talk, we have a repeat guest, Lena Dirhali, and she is joining us, obviously, via Skype. And for those who don't recall, we can put a link to the video that we previously did with her, but she wrote a book called My Daddy Is My Hero. And good day, Lena. How are you? And I hope you're doing well.
Thanks. I'm good, you know, considering all the craziness going on in the world. And I hope all the Crime Talk viewers are not too anxious about everything that's going on. I know that there's a lot of economic insecurity and fears around many different things. So I'm sending my good thoughts to everybody.
It's a crazy world. You know, our governor shut down yesterday, all restaurants and bars, so to speak. Yeah. And literally just laid off 250,000 people in the state of Colorado. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there that aren't sure how they're going to survive and make their bills. So, well, everyone will get through it, though. So just as a refresher for everyone out there, why don't you give us a quick, you know, bio of your education and what you do and, you know, why we like you.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I'm a licensed and Imago certified psychotherapist. And Imago, a quick refresher for people, is it's a relational theory, and it's a way to work with people on relationships using a lot of communication skills and conflict resolution and looking sort of at our childhood baggage and some of those unmet needs from childhood and how we're bringing that into our adult relationships. And I'm also, as you said, now an author of the book about Chris Watts, which I'm sure many of your viewers have seen that video before, My Daddy is a Hero. And I am also a clinical instructor at George Washington Medical School, and I mentor medical students there and teach them on, you know, bedside manner, compassionate care, and sort of mentor them through their own struggles as they go through medical school, especially now during this time of, you know, healthcare crisis. So I have that, and I have several master's degrees, one in communications and one in counseling, and an undergrad in psychology. And I've been in practice for almost 10 years now. So. Wow.
All right. So you've got the credentials to back up what you said. And I think that's why I think our video with you did so well, was because you do have that credibility and you put it out there, so to speak. Kind of, you tell people where you sit before you tell you where they where you stand, and just kind of lay it out there. And, you know, we're being an advocate for one side. So I think that's always important. So, you know, we have on our channel lots of people, obviously, that followed originally because of the Chris Watts case. Now we have, you know, other cases that just keep popping up, you know, in Houston, in Idaho, where these women are accused of killing their children. And so I mean, in Pennsylvania, there's a horrific case where the woman is accused of hanging her children with dog collars from the rafters in the basement. Yeah. And so I guess my question to you is, as a trained professional, how can somebody do that? It just seems to go against everything in nature of a mother to protect their young, so to speak.
Yeah.
Give me some insight on that.
Yeah. We need a lot of time for it because it's actually really complex. I've done a bunch of research on it, and actually there's not a lot of studies out there. You would think that there would be. The studies that are out there, you know, we're focused on trying to identify people who are at risk for killing their children in hopes of preventing it. And so I think that's you know, why we talk about the psychology and trying to understand this a lot as well. How do we identify at-risk people to prevent it? And it is really complicated. Although it's not as uncommon as people would think. You know, children in their first, 4 to 5 years of life are most likely to be killed by a parent than a stranger, which I just think is unbelievable. So you have that. There's, if we're talking about parents killing their children, there's several categories. There's something called neonaticide, which is the killing of a child within the first 24 hours of life. And almost 100% of the time that happens to a young mother or a poor mother. You know, you hear those stories, they give birth in the, you know, the high school prom in the bathroom, and they don't know what to do. Yeah. So you have a lot more insight into that type of child murder. But then when we have something like infanticide, which the definition is the killing of a child within the first year of life. And then we have maternal filicide and paternal filicide. So it's either the killing of the child by a mother or the killing of a child by a father. And I can go into, you know, some of the main motives, but they're a little bit different than mothers and fathers. So I would, where would you like me to go
first? Well, why don't we start off first? I mean, I think it's an interesting statistic, but not something that necessarily, I don't think it surprises me that if you're going to be killed as a child, you know, that's going to be usually by a parent, at least in the age, you know, between ages of birth and 4 to 5 years old. I mean, are most of these cases, you know, trying to identify people, you know, is it the mom that has, you know, postpartum depression, and, you know, they just wind up killing their children? The teenager that panics because she can't tell anybody that she's pregnant. I mean, why don't you just kind of start from there, and then we'll talk about, you know, mom, you know, dad's perspective, I guess.
So I'm going to give credit to Dr. Philip Resnick, and he's the guy who did a lot of research on the motives of maternal filicide, and he illustrated five main motives. So you named one of them, which is one of the more common ones, which is, you know, postpartum depression, or what they call acute psychosis. So acute psychosis is that there's no, you know, you can't comprehend, there's no comprehensible, you know, rationale as to why they would do it, but maybe they heard hallucinations. I think of Andrea Yates, which is one of the most famous cases of postpartum psychosis. So that is one of the more common ones. However, I think the most common motive, which I found surprising, was fatal maltreatment, it's called. And fatal maltreatment is when it's not an intent to kill the child, but the child dies as a result of repeated abuse, or, you know, someone's hurting their child and they go too far, or Munchausen by proxy is included in that. So for people who don't know what Munchausen by proxy is, it's when a parent, usually a mother, makes the child sick in hopes of getting attention, positive attention, or, you know, a lot of attention just for themselves. And
kind of as the caregiver. Look, I'm such a great caregiver for my sick child.
Yeah. And sometimes with Munchausen's, the parent, you know, there's a lot of true crime stories about that. The parent does intend to kill the child for sympathy for themselves. But a lot of the times, you know, that it's actually sometimes by accident. And so that's one of the more common motives behind that. We also have altruistic killings where, it, you know, that sort of goes along with Andrea Yates as well with her psychosis. She thought that she was doing her children a favor or saving them from harm. So they, when mothers kill their children for what they believe is altruistic reasons, they feel that they're doing it in the best interest of the child.
Well, is that somebody that's not necessarily, you know, suffering from a mental disease, or are they just trying to rationalize what they've done?
Personally, I think a lot of the time altruistic killings are kind of comorbid with mental illness, but in this particular, in Dr. Resnick's work, he separates them. So I don't think you have to necessarily be psychotic or mentally ill to do some sort of altruistic killing. But there's not enough research on there about that. But that's an interesting question. I'd like to see more research about that.
Okay.
The other one, which, you know, I think makes sense to a lot of people who watch your channel and some of the cases you've been talking about, is the unwanted child. And so that's when the child poses a burden to the parent and they don't want, they don't want the burden of that child anymore. So they kill them. And so those are, you know, some of the main reasons, main motivations that there's research behind.
How about, and it's been kind of a crazy morning, but the cases where somebody goes and kidnaps somebody else's child. Have you done any research on that? I mean, we had a case here in Boulder where a lady goes over, finds a woman who's pregnant, going to buy baby clothes, literally performs a C-section on her, takes her out. We have a case in Houston where the mother goes missing, and then her best friend, who everyone thought she was pregnant, turns out she has the child. I mean, it's kind of a flip side of it where somebody kills somebody else, but where somebody wants another child. I mean, is that kind of related, or someone wants a child so desperately they're going to kill for it versus somebody that doesn't want a child? I mean,
yeah, that could be part of it. Again, there's so many different factors that go into each case. There's mood disorders versus personality disorders. So personality disorders are, more what we talk about with the narcissism and the psychopathy and the antisocial and the histrionic. And that's separate than the mood disorders, which could include psychosis, like bipolar with psychotic episodes, depression with psychotic episodes, anxiety, PTSD, OCD, all of those things. So you could have a personality disorder and a mood disorder. There's a lot of research on a lot of people who do this stuff have a history of domestic violence in their own life or sexual abuse or physical abuse. And so there's all kinds of things that, again, I like to use the perfect storm that sort of culminate in very different and individual motives, but they can all sort of fall into one of the five categories that Dr. Resnick described.
Okay. Well, and I'm sorry, I got kind of sidetracked on you there. When you talk about infanticide, I mean, just kind of continue how that all plays out. I mean, what does the research say us? Can we predict this?
Well, the research, I have some numbers. I took some notes. It says 200 women kill their children a year. 3 to 5 children a day are killed by their parent. And homicide is one of the leading causes of death with children under age 4. So again, this is, and a lot of the time it is by a parent. And so, this is, and also what I found interesting, the U.S. is the highest rate of child homicide by a parent. It's a global problem, but it's highest here in the U.S., but it is a global problem. And so one of the things, when we look at how can we spot someone who may be at risk? I think definitely in the first year of life with infanticide, postpartum depression sets in usually within the first year after a child is born. And so we really want to try to look at how do we identify a person who's at risk for postpartum depression. I know, I've had so many friends that have had it, and it's a very shameful thing because a lot of the time they may have thoughts about harming their child, and it may not be something that they would ever do, but they're so ashamed of that they won't reach out for help and tell somebody about it. And that's where we sort of need to erase the stigma about that, because that's where I really worry, is that one day somebody has those thoughts, but they're too afraid to reach out for help because there's so much shame around that.
Yeah, I literally just had this conversation this morning about I was in court on a client, and there were some competency issues, and the family was explaining how this particular person who's just always kind of been a little off, so to speak. And when I grew up, people didn't talk about mental health issues. Everyone, they had this or that, and there was the crazy aunt or whatever. But nobody talked about it. And doing what I've done for 25 years now, it seems like everybody has some sort of mental health issue, but it's becoming more and more talked about, which makes it easier for people to get help so that they can live a normal and productive life. And when you talked about the postpartum depression, I've known people that have had that. And like you said, it's just they feel terrible that they would even think of that. I don't think they would act upon it, but just the mere thought of it.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say a doctor, but I think it's all a lot of hormonal changes and things like that. But
yeah, yeah.
It's a real thing. It's a real, real thing.
And depression is a real thing, too. And, I personally haven't suffered from it, but, I have loved ones that have and many clients that have. And I'm sure some of your viewers have it. And when you're in a depressive episode, it's a dark hole you can't get out of. And nobody can understand how hard that is. It's just you literally have no motivation to pull yourself out of it. And it's a very, very dark place. And it's really hard to ask for help. And so, you know, I think we do need, it can be frustrating for loved ones of those people because they can't really understand, well, why can't you get out of bed or why can't you just, you know, apply for that job? But we really need to have more education and compassion around that stuff so we can identify at-risk people for suicide or homicide or all of those things. I do think there is a route to mental illness, to social isolation, which kind of concerns me now about the coronavirus stuff that we're having so many people who are going to be socially isolated because loneliness is one of the biggest sources of depression and one of the biggest causes of death, actually, which is really interesting.
Yeah, it's. I mean, there's so many things. I mean, I love talking with you because, I mean, there's just so many things about, I mean, the isolation and people being lonely. There's a, I won't. Mm-hmm. I have some information. It was about a case where literally a student, it was at college, mm-hmm. and his roommate had moved out. It turned out nobody had gone upstairs until something started to smell and he had passed away. And nobody went and checked on him for over a week. His family didn't call or didn't ask anybody to follow up. It was because, you know, the smell. And it's kind of a sad story, like, you know, no one knows exactly what happened yet, but, you know, what was this young man going through? But on a college campus, nobody bothered to knock on a door and say, hey, I haven't seen you in a couple of days. Are you doing all right?
Yeah. And it's a bigger societal problem, too. You know, a lot of personality disorders are thought to have been caused from child abuse. So how do we identify at-risk youth who are victims of abuse so they don't go and perpetuate the same patterns of the family? So these are much bigger questions, you know, that require bigger answers and more access to healthcare that we won't get into that today on this show, but
sure.
You know, those are things that I hope by, you know, talking about this stuff and identifying it, you know, and looking out for those people that may be at risk, and getting them help or just being somebody that they can talk to. And that means listening without judgment.
Yeah. If anyone's ever had children, particularly the firstborn, if you're, you know, I don't care how well educated you are, how prepared you think you are, it turns your world upside down. And yeah, I have said this before to people, the hardest job in the world has got to be that of a single mother. I do not know how they do it, to do everything they need to do, plus work, plus get the kids to school, plus get them changed. Unbelievable. You know, it is a full-time job in and of itself.
And all single parents, dads and moms, hats off to them. It really.
And you can see how, you know, we see lots of times in child abuse cases where somebody just loses it, so to speak, and they shake the baby and, you know, that there's that frustration. And, you know, it's so preventable because maybe they just need a little bit of help. You know, you think if somebody knew they had a young kid, young couples, and that's usually what it is. It's not, you know, for the younger couple, it's usually the kids who are kids raising kids, that they harm this other child and think, oh, no one will notice, you know, they have broken bones or they're shaking baby. It's, you know, it's just sad that, you know, maybe people can look into that young couple across the way, see if they're doing okay, see if they need any, you know, a mental health break, you know, can I take the kid in the stroller around the block once or, you know what I mean, just to help people out because it can be stressful. And if you haven't been through it, it's easy to sit there and judge and say, ah, you know, I would never harm a child. But I don't think most people necessarily do that. But
there's another part too that I think is interesting, actually, that I'm thinking of now. As, you know, I took a class in college called Bad Mothers. And I'll always remember this class. It was about mothers who killed their children. And one of the focus was Diane Downs, you know. And while I was doing my research and, you know, just studying up for my interview with you, one of the quotes I came across was, not all women are natural mothers, but society conditions us to believe that they are. So I think that there's also this other part about not every woman is maternal and they have this instinct to be a mother. And I go back to college in that class and studying mothers who didn't have necessarily that maternal instinct. And I think they fall into that category of the child is a burden And then again, we're sort of looking at maybe some personality disorders there, like a little bit psychopathic, you know, very low empathy. So I think there is that part too, that we don't talk about that as a society, but not every woman is maternal and loves their children unconditionally. But we're all taught to, and most do, believe me, most do, but we're taught to think that every woman is going to be this nurturing, unconditional mother that is completely selfless. And I hate to say it, but so many of my adult clients, you know, are in therapy as an adult because of incredibly abusive parents who were very narcissistic and didn't put the child's needs ahead at all. In fact, it became a situation of what we call parentification, where the child is put in the role of the parent. And so there's parents out there who are not putting their children first and are not selfless people. So
can you give an example of that, where, you know, parentification, where the kids basically take care of, you know, the adults? I mean, I've seen situations where literally, you know, the 10, 12, 13 year old kid is taking care of alcoholic mom and or father to make sure they get through the day. And it's almost like enabling kind of.
Yeah. I mean, I've had a lot of clients with parents you know, if we're talking about mothers here, mothers with personality disorders or mood disorders. One that I can actually think of that I think emotional abuse can be the most harmful when it's neglect and ignoring. And I remember, you know, one client, her mother would punish her, you know, for no reason, but she would just shut down and not speak to her for weeks. And then the child, you know, doesn't understand what's going on and has, and, you know, for weeks is trying to console the mother, take care of the mother. What did I do wrong? You know, and then is put in this role of sort of parenting the child and managing their and doing all the emotional labor for that parent and managing all the emotions. And we have a lot of research coming out now that a lot of adult anxiety is created by parentification. Sometimes another example is when a child, sometimes it's the older sibling, is put in charge of raising the younger ones. And, you know, sometimes a parent will go out, get drunk. I remember, you know, a client, 7 years old, waking up, the parent was gone and she was alone with screaming babies with dirty diapers. 7 years old, had to change diapers. Mother was out partying. So, you know, they're forced to become adults really quickly. And, it creates a world of anxiety and distrust as adults.
Yeah, like I said, I think I've grown over the years where I used to think, you know, I was in the Marine Corps. This is the way it is. Just suck it up. You can move on. But as I get older, you really are shaped by your childhood, what your parents did or didn't do. I think you either decide I'm going to be just like them because it was great, or I'm going to be the complete opposite.
Right.
Because I hated that so much growing up.
Right.
Or it really does affect you.
It does. Yeah. And you know, another thing too, is that we also need to look at motherhood is not necessarily martyrdom or selflessness either. Yes. I think when you have a child, for me, at least when I decided to have children, I made a conscious decision that, you know, it's not about me anymore. I brought them into the world. They didn't ask for it. And I'm going to make sure that I keep them as safe as possible, that I make them feel as secure and unconditionally loved as possible. But, you know, I think a lot of mothers, and this is where we fall into mothers with depression and at-risk mothers as well, is when they completely self-sacrifice and, you know, this martyrdom, and they don't take care of themselves either. And so there sort of has to be the balance of wellness and taking care of yourself while also, you know, putting your children's needs as a priority as well.
I know a lot of professional women, very successful, who are incredible mothers, but they always feel guilty because they want their children, they love their children, they would do anything for their kids, but they also enjoy their profession.
Yeah.
And they feel guilty that, oh, I've got to go travel and I'm going to miss, you know, back to school night.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think they're going to go harm their children, but the amount of guilt you talk about, that, you know, these parents, because, you know, like you said, you can have the children and have this successful career, and it's tough.
Yeah,
there's a lot of guilt.
Yeah, a lot of guilt, a lot of choices we have to make every day, and nobody ever gave us a manual for how to do it. And I think that's really hard too. People are just, you know, from my Imago perspective, everybody's just doing the best they can. And a lot of the times our parents were doing the best they could with what they had, you know, and it goes back to nobody teaches us how to be in relationships. And we really kind of need courses in school for how to do this because none of us have that manual. And I always say to people too, I'm a couples therapist. I have relationship education and all this stuff, right? And my marriage is not perfect. My marriage is conscious work every day, you know? And so I tell people, imagine somebody like me who's been trained, has the relationship education, has gone to relationship school, and it's still work for me. So I think there's a lot of work to be done. Like we need more education. It's relationships are hard, all of them.
They are. And it's like anything, if you don't focus on it, yeah. And particularly when you start having children, it all becomes about the kids. And right. Then one day you're sitting there looking at your spouse saying, who are you and why do I like you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. We don't. But you realize it was always about the kids and you go out and all of a sudden you're thinking, okay, kids are old enough. We can have a night out. And then you sit there and talk about the kids and realize you have nothing in common anymore. I'm just speaking from my own personal experience. But it's hard and you got to focus and say, what are we going to do to make it a priority? You know,
Actually one thing, when I think Kyle had requested to do the interview with me initially, and he had mentioned stepchildren that kill their parents. And I don't know if you wanted to talk about that either, because I did some research into that.
Yeah,
Because I think one of the cases that you've been talking about was a stepmother. That was Letitia Stouch, right? Is that how you say her name?
Yes.
He's a stepmother.
Letitia Stouch. Like Stouch with a K. Stouch.
Got it. Yes.
And she's down in Colorado Springs. She charged with first degree murder, and she is the stepmother. Well, it sounds like natural mother had some issues, and that's why she didn't have primary custody of the kid. The father's in the military. She's kind of taking care of him, and then last one with him and disappears.
So it just goes back to sort of nature versus nurture. Like at the end of the day, parents are biologically and evolutionarily, wired to protect and unconditionally love our children. That's our society wouldn't function if we weren't like the most of us weren't like that. And so that's why the comparisons between biological parents who killed their children and step parents are quite extreme. And there's something called the Cinderella effect, which is when step-parents kill their children. So most people are, familiar with the Cinderella story.
Well, for
Cinderella is abused by her stepmother.
Correct.
Not killed by her, but they call it the Cinderella effect. So children who live with a step-parent are 40 to 100 times more likely to be murdered or maimed than if they lived with two biological parents. And so step-parents kill their children more than biological parents do. And, the thought behind that is that they don't consider them kin. They don't have that attachment to them. And when we're looking at attachment theory and bonding, it's really thought to happen a lot of it in the first 2 years of life. And often, step parents don't have that same type of bonding. That being said, there's a lot of people who have great step parents and great blended families. So it's not to say that they're bad, but I did find it interesting in the research that, step-parents way more likely to kill a child than a biological parent.
And simply for the fact that, they may have liked part of the deal, but they didn't necessarily like this part of the package and just, being the kids and just thought, not my kin, so to speak. And it just makes it easier. I mean, not that it should be easy to kill anybody, but that's the way they kind of rationalize it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's also, a lot of talk with any kind of child homicide by a parent or step-parent. There's a lot of external factors and stress, too. It could be bankruptcy, financial issues. Sometimes they say, step-parents, they may have more stress in that family. And so there can be more abuse sometimes. So there's those external stress factors that come into it as well. But I thought that was interesting in talking about Letitia Stout. Just that she didn't have that biological need to protect.
Yeah, but what about the other spouse or the other, I mean, the biological parent that's there with the blended family.
Yeah.
How can they let that happen? I mean, obviously, assuming most of the time they don't, but there has to be some sort of sign that they're, I mean, in the Stauch case, there's talk about abuse, humiliation, and things of that nature that took mm-hmm. place beforehand. Why would the other spouse allow that to take place?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And again, it's hard for, I think it's hard for a lot of us who are parents and who feel like we would protect our children. We would do anything to protect our children. A lot of the time, again, I often wonder, were those biological parents in abusive homes as children? And that's the norm for them, you know, and they don't actually know how to get out of it, you know. So a lot of the times with abuse that happens, you also have that sort of the Stockholm syndrome stuff where, you know, the captor starts to identify and protect the abuser. So you have all kinds of psychological dynamics, you know, that go on.
Yeah.
But it is, I think, you know, for me, it's so hard to understand, again, why somebody would not do everything in their power to protect their children from any harm. You know, it's just, you would throw yourself, most parents would throw themselves in front of a bus for their kids. They would do anything to protect their kids. So,
yeah.
That's why I'm so fascinated with this stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen it. There's this scene, it's in the show on Netflix called, I think it's called Working Moms. And she has all this guilt. She's a professional woman. She has this young child. And, you know, she's like starting to doubt whether she can be a good mom because she really likes her job, but she feels like she should be torn. Anyway, she's out running one day in the woods and she comes across this bear. And she literally kind of looks at the bear and doesn't turn around and run away or do anything. She literally steps in front of the stroller to protect her child and basically yells and screams and kind of like saying, "Hey, Mr. Bear, you're going to have to get through me to get to the child." And the bear kind of backs down and goes away. And I've mentioned that before because I think that's what most people think of that mentality of mothers protecting their children. Like, you're going to have to get through me to get to this child. And then there's other people that are like, I'm going to do harm to this child. It's just, like I said, as a parent, it just seems very odd to me that how people can do that. But I've represented lots of people over the years that, well, you know, I really love the new boyfriend and, you know, he's going to take care of the little baby while I'm at work and, you know, winds up abusing him, then makes excuses for him. I mean, I don't get it.
Sometimes, again, that boils down to, like, what's going on in the brain there? Are these people really low empathy? Do they have these, you know, sociopathic, psychopathic, narcissistic traits, you know, where it's me, me, me. It's all about me and not, and other people's needs don't matter. And, that doesn't exclude parents, you know. There's narcissistic people and psychopathic people that become parents, and they're out there, but they don't have those urges to protect their children, and they'll put themselves and their needs before their children.
Have you been following the Lori Vallow case of the woman in Idaho?
I started after I talked to you guys. That's a really interesting one. I mean, that is a documentary series in itself with all the stuff going on there.
Yeah, with all the dead relatives.
There's like five ex-husbands, five husbands or something. She's on her fifth or something like that.
She's on her fifth, you know, a stepchild, adopted child. I think JJ was adopted, I think. Then the daughter was hers. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. I'm not trying to disparage her, but, you know, she's, you know, it seems to be all about her and her daughter, the missing daughter. You know, she seems, but she didn't look like she was going to, you know, fit her mother's ideals or expectations as kind of the perfect child. And now, of course, they're missing, you know, and maybe they're fine, but I think common sense tells us they're not. But we'll, you know, until we know definitively, we don't want to speculate, but I mean, I think that's the classic example. I think if people look and say, this is a narcissistic woman, it's all about her. What's the next best thing?
Didn't I read I might've read something and you may be able to help me on this, where she entered the court, like dressed very flamboyantly. Was that her? I think there was
originally, she had a hearing in Hawaii, kind of a first appearance, like, hey, no big deal. Then when she was brought back for court in Idaho, you know, she had her hair curled. She had on this jailhouse lipstick that was made, because they don't give them lipstick in jail. So they, you know, they take the coloring from like M&Ms and things like that to to do it. But, you know, she was more concerned about trying to look good in court, knowing that the cameras are going to be there, than dealing with where are her children. And, oh my gosh, are they going to reduce my bond from $5 million to $1 million that she's still in custody for?
Yeah.
And she looked very cool, calm, and collected, and not a worry in the world.
I mean, that's when you have a high suspect level for narcissism. And then she, that was a histrionic tendency she had there. Histrionic is also in the cluster with narcissism. And they love to get attention by being flamboyant and being sort of, it's sometimes sexual. And, very, you know, I think we're seeing a lot more of it than we used to because of social media and Instagram influencers. You can sort of see these people now, how much they need people, you know, voyeurism. They need people to look at them and give them attention. And they'll do sort of all these, you know, bright colors and put themselves out there to get that attention. And those people also tend to be high on narcissism, low on empathy. You know, it's, again, it's this me, focus on me. But yeah, I think those people, you know, there's probably other comorbid stuff going on. I think that's probably a very complex case, but definitely we're looking at somebody with, you know, doesn't care about other people. If this husband number five,
next.
I haven't, and a lot of them, the past, a lot of the exes are dead, right? I mean, that's just a whole next level case.
Yeah. So we know, obviously, you know, mothers, young mothers, recently delivered children, they're at risk. Step parents are more likely to kill a non-biological child. Mm-hmm. Like you said, is there any way to predict this stuff? I mean, wouldn't it be nice if everybody could look in the crystal ball and say, oh, we know that, you know, this is the person that's going to do it. I mean, the old adage, past performance is indicative of future results. Can we tell?
Yeah. I mean, the problem is too, and I think you probably see this in your line of work, and I see this in my line of work, is even if somebody is exhibiting the symptoms, we can't necessarily get them to help. Like, you could have somebody threaten to kill your family, but if they don't explicitly say how they're going to do it, the police aren't going to do anything. You know what I mean? They could be having a psychotic episode. There's, you know, so a lot of the time we've identified, I think, when we're looking at mass shootings, like Sandy Hook, for example, and the Parkland one in Florida, in Parkland, people were calling the FBI on that guy.
Yeah. I mean, they just said, this isn't right. This kid is saying things.
And Sandy Hook, Adam Lanza, I mean, he was screaming warning signs for years, you know, from his drawings and his stories to his behavior to everything. But the problem is we can't really do anything about it, you know, even when we can identify them, and at least with those things. And that, I think that's something that, you know, we really need to look at from a prevention standpoint, is how do we, you know, but while keeping our freedoms too. You know,
that's the tricky
your line of work. Right?
I mean, yeah, that's the tricky area. It's not a crime to be weird, somewhat despondent, a loner, dress unusual, like firearms. You know, I mean, that's it's not a crime unless you actually do something, and the police can't stop you until you do something.
Right.
And now, for example, they have all these red flag laws that are being passed. They just passed it here in Colorado, where if somebody is related to you or lives with you, been in a relationship, if you have a concern about them, you can red flag them and say, hey, they're a danger, take away their firearms. Mm-hmm. And they're going to say, but I haven't done anything. But they come and take your firearms, and then they give you a hearing and saying that's okay. And it's ex parte, which means only one party, the person signing the application, gets to be there. And this person may know something and say, well, this person threatened me, or he said this, that I'm going to hurt myself and you. But unless they actually do something, our judicial system has always been in the mindset we don't violate people's rights without, we can't take their property without due process of law, and they're taking it.
Right. Or we can't arrest them before they've done anything or put them in a psychiatric hospital. You know, a lot of the times, you know, I've known mentally ill people where mobile crisis units have been called, and you try to get them committed if they're, they have suicidality or they've threatened homicide. And then, you know, the mobile crisis unit shows up and they're like, oh, I was just kidding. And then they're like, oh, okay, well, they were just kidding, so we can't do anything. So yeah. There's a lot of people who are very frustrated at how hard it is to get people, especially people who are, you know, need medication and aren't, you know, to involuntarily commit somebody is quite hard. You know, restraining orders can be quite useless. We have the case of Dr. Amy Harwick in Los Angeles. I don't know if you followed that case.
We did. We actually talked about it where she was the counselor, and she was dating a gentleman, and I guess she previously dated Drew Carey, the comedian guy from now he does Price is Right. And there were warning signs all over this guy, and apparently he allegedly goes over there and throws her off the balcony.
Yeah, and the crazy thing about that one is she hadn't dated him in 10 years. He had been, he had had these obsessions with her on and off for 10 years, and she had had restraining orders. I mean, he had thrown her out the side of the road on a highway. He, you know, pummeled her head, all this. She had restraining orders against him, and then, you know, here she is 10 years later after breaking up with him. She runs into him at a red carpet event. His obsession reignites, and she's telling everybody she's scared for her life. And he breaks into her house and hides out there, waits for her, and then strangles her and throws her off the third floor balcony.
So,
you know, there's been a lot of talk about that with, you know, the restraining order. Yeah, I mean, there's often not a lot we can do even when the signs are there. And again, those are just bigger conversations about, you know, and again, I think it actually just comes down to how do we get these people the right mental health help before something happens? And that's something that as a society we need to be looking at.
Yeah, it is a difficult issue, one that, you know, people have been struggling with for years and years and years. You know, the lady that's being, you know, somebody's being stalked. Well, do you get a protection order? Hopefully that's going to stop him. It's probably not worth the paper it's written on. It may actually exacerbate him.
It could, yeah.
Or if somebody is not right mentally, they're going to say, oh, well, this is her way of saying, come get me. I'm hard, you know, playing hard to get or something. Yeah. And I'm not saying that's what I'd say. That's what some people try to rationalize that.
Yeah.
And then society has this issue of, we have our individual liberties that we're there to protect.
Yeah.
And then you have the other side. Well, if it would save one life, wouldn't it be worth it? And then you have to weigh, is it really worth taking away someone's civil liberties? Because then they maybe take yours. But in a free society, there's consequences to that. I mean, it's a fascinating subject to think about, because you have people that need help. Well, let's get them help. But you can't make them get help.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
What do you do? So, you have to wait till they hurt somebody.
I know. So these are, you know, these are things that I don't have the answers to, but I would like to, find them one day for sure.
Wow. So the bottom line is we can't really predict who's going, you know, I've said this to juries, you know, what does a murderer look like?
Yeah.
You don't know, right?
No.
I mean, you can always, it's easy to look back and say, well, this was a sign, but nobody acted upon it, or what are they going to do about it?
Yeah.
And, you know, how about, we talked a lot about mothers. What about fathers that kill their children? I mean, obviously the first one that comes to mind is Chris Watts.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody can still explain or rationalize that one. Because it makes no sense. I mean, even if you kill your wife, like your own kids, and the manner in which you did that is just absolutely shocking to anybody. And so, I mean, is there any research out there on why fathers kill?
There is, and interestingly enough, they don't really mention the burden of the children on the father as one of, especially when you look at family annihilators, they don't mention the burden of the children as much as other things. But with men who kill their children, it's often in conjunction with their own suicide or the killing of the mother.
Yeah.
I also forgot to mention when mothers kill their children, one of the least common reasons is a revenge killing against like the husband or spouse. So they kill the child to punish the father of the child. Fathers who kill their children, that is one of the motives as well, is to punish the mother or the wife. They kill the children, but oftentimes they kill themselves as well, and they kill the wife. You also have, you know, psychosis with men. And then there's altruistic killings with men as well. And then there's financial, you know, where there's, it's related to a financial stress or a bankruptcy or a shame around that.
Yeah.
There was this guy in Connecticut, the chiropractor.
Yeah, that just moved to Florida and he wound up killing.
Yeah, yeah.
He was under indictment for fraud. Yeah.
And there's a couple family annihilator cases where you had sort of similar. There's, again, the male, there's a male need, you know, to provide and feel like a provider, and that they get, you know, men can feel respect from being a provider. And there's, you know, a male psychology behind that. And when a man, you know, feels like he can't provide or that he's a failure in those ways, there's a tremendous amount of shame. And so, you know, men will often commit suicide around a lot of failure and shame-based things, especially as it relates to their career, identity, money, being able to provide.
But can you explain how somebody could get there? So let's say, you know, whether you're working and you need to make more money, you go get another job, you start a side hustle versus this is what I'm doing. My family, I can't provide for them. Somehow I'm a terrible husband, so I'm going to kill my children and or myself. I mean, that just what takes somebody to get to that point? What does it take?
I think, you know, 80% of family annihilators do kill themselves after they kill their family, which I think, again, made the Chris Watts case such an anomaly because he's in that 20% that clearly didn't seem to have any intent in killing himself. And so I think, you know, the human spirit is very resilient. We have you know, I raise a lot of money for children who have PTSD from war, and people who survive wars amaze me. Like the resilience of people who can be through so much and witness so much and still have the will to live is incredible. You know, you see people or you hear about people who go through the worst circumstances and you think, oh my gosh, I would never be able to live if that happened to me. You know, people that lose their entire families in one day in a car accident or something like that.
Yeah.
But people have, you know, we are again wired to live and have this will to live, most of us. So when you think of having to kill someone else or especially, you know, kill yourself, is that you have to be in a very deep place of desperation. And I think, again, we're kind of probably looking at comorbid mental illness, you know, that they're in a deep, deep place of desperation in that moment, even, you know, when I did research for my book on snapping and the brain. And I there's a great book that I used in my book. It's called Why We Snap by neuroscientist Dr. Douglas Fields. And he looks at, you know, the things that push us over the edge that happen in the brain that make us commit those things. And almost all of the times, you know, there's 9 triggers that will provoke a violent response in a person. And so, you know, those are laid out in his book. We can do a few examples if you want.
Sure.
But almost all of the time, if someone becomes violent, whether to themselves or others, in addition to a trigger in the brain, it's also almost always a stress or cumulative stress. And people kind of have these moments or breaks from reality without necessarily being insane for weeks or months. And they're, you know, they're slowly being pushed to the edge until they can't take it anymore. But they're not necessarily psychotic. You know, one of a couple things that Dr. Fields talked about, the one I talked about in my book, which I think is really interesting, is he calls it the S trigger, the stopped trigger. And so all the 9 neural pathways that trigger a rage response in the brain are based on our primitive need to survive. And so now as we're in we've adapted to modern times, we don't need to survive. We don't have the same threats anymore, but we still have the primitive brain that misfires. And so when we have the S trigger, it's stopped. That means we can fly into a rage if we feel like we're being stopped from, or our desires are being impeded. And that can be as simple as, you know, being in line, at a long line in a grocery store. And, you know, you have somewhere to be, and you can't get there because the line, like, you can snap because it's a misfire in your brain of, you know, primitive stuff going on about you being stopped from being able to get something for your survival, for example. So,
but, you know, I guess the big question then is, why do some people, when they're getting that stress level, just, like, you know, sit there and count to 10, and other people do snap? I mean, are they just not wired correctly, or they can't control it? It's just so great of
yeah,
of
Dr. Fields, I think, believes anybody is capable of snapping given the right circumstances. But I do think, you know, again, we're kind of wired and born with certain personality traits. And some of us are just calmer people than others, or just, you know, just prone to sort of dealing with stress better. But yeah, again, in order for, I think, a lot of rage response to happen when it gets to that point, like you said, where we're killing someone, is I think there has to be a lot of stress. And very serious stress surrounding that, which again can be a bankruptcy, a divorce. You know, that happens a lot when a father kills the family, is the mother's threatening to leave and take the kids, or, you know, so the father's losing access to the kids, and he may feel his entire world is crumbling around him, and then he's being stopped from, you know, having the life that he wants. You know, and then all that other stress combines and. There could be other factors going in there too, you know.
Yeah, I just
so
you know,
many different things.
You know, I have to go.
There's
see,
not.
I have to go see a client this afternoon who's in custody, and you know, he kind of snapped, so to speak. And you know, the first thing I want to say is, why didn't you just let it go? You know, let it go. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I think people become so focused that this is the only problem, and this is the only thing that matters, and it doesn't really matter what happens after this, because this is the only thing that matters, you know, and they snap. And like I said, I think it's just curious and interesting why some people just let it go and others can't. They can't just let it go.
Yeah. And I think what was helpful for me actually when I interviewed Dr. Fields was, and why he wrote his book, is he wanted to learn how to prevent violence. And he teaches people, if you can understand what those 9 triggers are and you can identify them when you're angry, you can tell yourself it's your brain having a misfire. So, you know, he says, if somebody bumps into you in the crowd, your primitive brain is like, oh, I'm being threatened. Somebody, you know, bumped me. And you immediately tense up. But then if the person says, oh, I'm so sorry, you calm down immediately, because it's your brain recognizing that there's no threat. And you know, the person kind of calmed you down. And so, I think his book is really helpful just in understanding for my own self, because we all have moments like road rage. I mean, who doesn't have road rage when they're in traffic, or, you know, levels of it, meaning like everybody gets frustrated in traffic. And, you know, we're late, we have to be somewhere, and we're, you know, cursing or getting mad. And then, you know, it's been helpful for me ever since talking to Dr. Fields to be like, okay, this is my brain misfiring. I'm not, you know, there's no threat. I'm going to listen to my music and just, you know, try to be zen and be in the moment and be in the present. And that sort of helps calm me down when I started recognizing my own misfires in my own brain.
Yeah, I've, you know, tried to tell people over the years that most of us don't have real problems. We have inconveniences. And I think that's what people need to realize sometimes when they just won't let things go or they realize, hey, I'm misfiring.
Yeah.
It's an inconvenience. It'll get over it. It's not the end of the world here.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Hey. Well, another trigger is insult. So an insult, Dr. Field said, could be perceived insult. So it's all how you perceive the insult. But people get really angry when they feel insulted, or they perceive an insult, even if what was said wasn't intended to be an insult. So,
oh, yes.
Yeah, people really don't like to be insulted. But again, that's back to our primitive survival stuff.
Well, that's funny you should say that, because I was trying to explain this to someone the other day, is that so much what it is about in the criminal justice system is respect. You know, think, oh, why was there this shooting? Why did somebody do this? Well, they disrespected them. And people are like, well, I don't understand that. Just give the other person dignity and respect, and usually the problems won't go there. But when they perceive that disrespect, I'm going to go back to my car and get that gun and shoot them because they bumped into me and they didn't apologize. It wasn't respectful or something. And some people think that's completely crazy, but that's the way, you know, a lot of people react that way. And if you ever talk to people that go to prison, it's all about respect. You can't do something unless somebody gives you permission. Oh, you did that without them. Now we have to come beat you up because you didn't pay your respects. It's it's very interesting, and it's somewhat very primitive as well. But it makes so much sense when you, like, for example, the research that you cited about when people snap, they just don't. They're not getting the respect they think they deserve. It's fascinating.
And again, snapping doesn't have to be in an instant. You know, it can be a break from reality that occurs over weeks to even months sometimes. It's just like, just not in reality. It doesn't mean you're psychotic, but it's like, you know, you're being pushed to, you know, it's not, you're not conscious that your brain is having this sort of long lasting provoked rage response until you finally go through with it. And so I think there's a lot of education around the neuroscience part. And I think that is one thing that we can really look at, I think, for mindfulness as we go forward, is understanding how our brains react to threat.
Yeah. If you're having that break from reality, is there any way of knowing if you're having that break to say, bring it back so that somebody can identify? Or, you know, I think we kind of touched on it earlier, where people, family members, someone has mental health issues, and you're just like, well, why can't you just snap out of it? Why don't you get over your depression? You know, get back to work. You know, that kind of thing. Can you identify it individually without knowing?
Yeah, education is really important. Like I said, once I talked to Dr. Fields and he started explaining the 9 triggers, I started to really understand, you know, I started to be able to sort of mitigate my own, or as we call in Imago, reptilian brain responses, when it's your sort of flash survival instinct that we all have when we get triggered, you know, by something. Even in relationships, from the Imago perspective, it's like when we fight with our partner and we have these sort of volatile conflicts, you know, verbal, there's something in our reptilian brain that's getting triggered. And so understanding and what those things are and why we're being triggered, it's super helpful for my clients. It's super helpful for me. So, there's a lot of awareness. Once we understand ourselves, we can help not have those knee jerk reactions as much anymore. And that's why I think Imago is so effective, with couples, is that they really start having some self-awareness about their own motivations and working hard to not fall into the same destructive patterns that they once did.
Yeah. And it sounds cheesy. I can't believe I would say that if you had talked to me 25 years ago, you know, a lot of self-awareness, communication were probably not things in my vocabulary, but it really does matter. Yeah. It really does. And people just need to talk about stuff more, stuff that makes them uncomfortable so that they can become educated, because most people think they're the only ones dealing with it. And the reality of it is they're not. There's so many people that deal with the same issues.
Yep.
And I think if they realize and understand that there are people out there in similar situations, there's not the stigma that, oh, we can't talk about it anymore.
Yeah. So. Yeah. We're all in this together. We're not alone. We all have issues. All of us.
And there's nothing wrong with asking for help. I mean,
nope.
Ask somebody that's been through it. Ask somebody that, tell me where you can go to get help. Particularly,
and our,
you know,
flaws,
if somebody.
Our issues, they make the, it all makes us stronger, though. Once, you know, we can accept our flaws and issues and grow, it makes you stronger. So, makes you a better person.
Exactly.
So, it's all worth it in the end.
Absolutely. Hey, Lena, thank you for taking your time today. I think we're right about an hour or so. I appreciate you doing this. Hopefully we can do it again soon as well. Hopefully you enjoy it as much as I enjoy having you here, because you really are very intelligent and very insightful. And I think our viewers will really appreciate having somebody with your background explain, you know, these, why people do what they do, why people kill their children. And, you know, it's nice to have somebody give that perspective.
Thanks, Scott. I always love talking to you, and you have a great platform, and thank you for using it for these topics. And I'm really appreciative of it and of you.
Well,
so thank you.
Well, thank you. Have a great day, and we'll do it again soon. All right.
Be safe. Be well.
All right. Wash your hands like everybody else. Social distancing so you don't get sick, all right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. But we're definitely social distancing here, so we're good.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. See you later.
All right.
Bye, Scott. Bye.